It's 4:06 and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Wisconsin's 56 free clinics are staffed with volunteers who treat uninsured patients for anything from the flu to cancer. As the Affordable Care Act now requires all people to get insurance, there are questions about what this all means for the future of free clinics.
In part two of our week-long series looking at the Affordable Care Act, we have Maureen McCollum with more.
At InHealth Community Wellness Clinic in Boscobel, dental coordinator Maureen Cole is helping a volunteer dentist clean a patient's teeth. The clinic is open a couple times a week for free medical and dental care. 60-year-old Cole not only works at InHealth, but has been a patient for years. She has debilitating arthritis in her knees, but has not been able to afford a double knee replacement or insurance to cover it.
You know it's bad when your dentist is telling you you really need to get your knees fixed because you're tearing your teeth up in the back because you're biting so bad.
Cole has high hopes for the federal marketplace now available through the Affordable Care Act. She even stayed up until midnight the day it opened to be one of the first to purchase coverage. But Cole's still not sure she can afford insurance, even with federal subsidies.
If you shell out, we'll say $500 a month for 12 months, you know, that's a pretty big hit out of my husband's on retirement, and I have this. A tax credit isn't going to give us a lot of break. Now, if it was something instantly, that would be different.
Cole says she'd love to get care outside the free clinic. Jerry Bass is another regular InHealth patient who comes monthly to get his prescriptions filled. Bass works at a nearby winery, but says he could only afford to pay so much for health insurance monthly. He's currently paying off medical bills from years ago, and he lives paycheck to paycheck.
It'd be like going out and buying a new car. I mean, I don't know what they would charge a month, $200, $100, $300. But if that was the case, then, you know, I still don't know what we'd do.
Bass is like many patients who go to free clinics. He does not know much about the Affordable Care Act. Most clinics are doing what they can to educate people. Some places are handing out informational pamphlets, while others are training volunteers to sign up people for the marketplace. It's still unclear if Wisconsin's free clinics will end up with more or less patients. There will always be a need to treat undocumented immigrants, people who don't want coverage, and people who fall through the cracks. 92,000 people will lose Badger Care Plus coverage this year after the state rejected federal Medicaid expansion funds. The intent is for these people to purchase their own insurance. St. Clair Health Mission is a free clinic in La Crosse. Executive Director Sandy Brecky believes that some of the people who will lose their Medicaid coverage will seek care at the clinic. That includes people who fall under certain poverty levels. For example, a single person making about $11,500 to less than $16,000 annually.
So that's a group that we're waiting to see really when they get into the marketplace and they apply, even with the cost sharing and the tax credits, are they going to be able to afford it?
A Kaiser Family Foundation study found that uninsured adults in Wisconsin will not fall into this predicted coverage gap next year. Also, some low-income people will be exempted from the penalties that come with not purchasing health insurance. Regardless how many people will still need care at free clinics, Brecky and others say they ultimately want to close their doors.
People die because they waited until something was so bad. There was nothing more that could be done for them. You know, if I am out of a job because everybody that needs health care has health care, that'll be a great day for me.
But Brecky says she doesn't see that happening anytime soon. Maureen McCollum, Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse.
Thanks to Maureen for that report.
Today, Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch held a joint news conference to discuss U.S. drone strikes in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and the Middle East.
Each organization released a report. Amnesty International looked at drone strikes in Pakistan, and Human Rights Watch focused on airstrikes in Yemen. They're calling on Congress to investigate the strikes in their reports and disclose evidence of human rights violations to the public.
What do you think of U.S. drone strikes? We want to hear from you. Do you think they're good for national security? Are you worried about the human rights impact and the human toll it takes? Call 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or email us, talk@WPR.org. With us, we have Letta Taylor, Senior Terrorism and Counterterrorism Researcher at Human Rights Watch. Letta, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
And also Rachel O'Leary, Deputy Director of Membership at Amnesty International. Rachel, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with you. The Human Rights Watch report examined 6 U.S. drone strikes in Yemen. How did you choose which strikes to focus on, and how did you investigate?
Yes, well, first, actually, many of the strikes we investigated were drone strikes, but at least 2 of them were other U.S. strikes, one involving cruise missiles and cluster munitions, and another probably involving warplanes, but that was drone-assisted. We chose the 6 strikes because, well, first, they were 6 that jumped out on us from the initial information we had as clear or potential violations of the laws of war, and secondly, because they looked at a variety of policy and legal issues involved in the targeted killings program that we felt needed to be explored, including the issue of whether the U.S. is killing people it could be capturing, whether it is indiscriminately attacking civilians, and whether it's using an overly broad interpretation of who exactly is a militant eligible for combating, for targeting.
Let's get into the questions of civilians. Is the United States indiscriminately targeting civilians?
In some cases, the U.S. has indiscriminately killed civilians. We do not believe the United States is indiscriminately targeting them, but in 2 of the 6 cases we examined in Yemen, there were clear cases of indiscriminate attacks. One case killed 14 alleged al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula members. So that's the Yemen-based branch of al-Qaeda. But it also killed 41 sleeping Bedouins, many of them women and children, for example. But we don't believe the U.S. targeted those sleeping Bedouins. However, under international law, even if it was a horrible accident, if the U.S. Did indiscriminately strike civilians, it did not take the precautions it should have, and that is a violation of the laws of war for which the U.S. Should take responsibility.
We'll get more into the stories you heard in Yemen, but I want to turn to Pakistan now. Rachel, why did Amnesty International focus on the drone strikes there?
Well, we looked at a bunch of different drone strikes. I think there was 45 sort of reported drone strikes that we looked into. But we looked because we heard reports and wanted to research the reports that there were extrajudicial killings, that there were killings happening, that civilians were being struck. And so we wanted to research more for a lot of the same reasons that Human Rights Watch wanted to.
And what were some of your findings there in Pakistan?
Largely the same story, and what we're seeing is a consistent pattern of behavior where we're not sure. There's so much. The thing that always strikes me is that there's so much that we don't know. We don't know how folks get on the kill lists and the people who are targeted, and then we really also don't know how the folks that are targeted and killed, how that sort of came to be. So what we found out is that there's just so much that we don't know. And the results of our report are sort of case studies about different civilians that were killed in drone strikes. And specifically what, our sort of focus is and our appeal is that we are really urging President Obama to explain why these civilians were killed and how Congress can work to investigate these killings, because they're just so – we also don't believe that they were targeted, but we don't know there's just so much that we don't know. It's so much easier to talk about what we don't know versus what we do know around drone strikes and how and when they're executed in Pakistan.
Tell us one of the stories you found about civilians dying in one of these attacks in Pakistan.
Sure. So one of the cases that we know is of a grandmother who is out in her field picking okra, along with her, I believe it was her 8-year-old grandchild. And in front of her grandchild's eyes, she was struck and killed by a drone. And that was, devastating, obviously, for the child. It was, very it was a very graphic description of, you know, sort of the drone strikes. And I think, you know, when we're here, we hear drone strikes in the context of national security and in the context of saving American lives. But what really strikes me about the narrative of, you know, sort of the strikes that we found in our report is that, it's not clear that it makes us any safer. And it's very clear that we, you know, that the, amount of civilians and the amount of innocent, sort of lives that are taken, you know, as a result of these strikes are alarming enough, that we just need to know who they are, what's happening, and then, you know, perhaps down the road, even begin talking about, sort of making, you know, sort of, retribution to the families of those that are killed. But that even just seems so far down the road, because what we're talking about now are just really basic things like, where are these lists and how can we see them? And moreover, why will the president not answer us about why and how this happened in the first place, and why is Congress not acting?
Let me ask you, apart from what Rachel was just advocating for, is there talk in your organization of calling for an end to these strikes altogether?
No, at Human Rights Watch, we are not calling for an end to targeted killings, nor altogether. And we do not consider drones in and of themselves illegal. Drones have become a buzzword for the targeted killing program. Drones actually can strike in quite a discriminatory fashion, and that's a good thing. They're precision strikes, unlike a strike we documented, one of the six we documented in Yemen, that involved cluster munitions, which are, by their very nature, indiscriminate. So we do not take that position, but we share Amnesty's concern, and we called jointly in a news conference today with Amnesty for the U.S. To come clean exactly who it's killing, how many of those it's killed it believes are civilians, and to show what it's doing to hold those responsible for unlawful attacks to account. The question of compensation is, it's not just a matter of good public relations for the United States to compensate the families of civilians unlawfully killed in these strikes. It's also a legal obligation. And so the U.S. and these families really have no recourse to redress, to which they're entitled under international law, unless they know what exactly the U.S. government was up to when it killed their relatives. So the transparency issue ties into the U.S. legal obligations. The world has a right to know. The families of victims have a right to know.
We're talking to Letta Taylor with Human Rights Watch and Rachel O'Leary with Amnesty International. Their organizations released reports on U.S. strikes, drone strikes, and others in Yemen and Pakistan, respectively.
And what do you think about the use of U.S. drone strikes? Do you have concerns about human rights violations? What do you think we need these strikes for national security reasons? Should they stop? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. We continue our conversation about U.S. drone strikes in Pakistan and Yemen. We have Letta Taylor with Human Rights Watch, Rachel O'Leary with Amnesty International. Both groups issued reports on strikes today. We'll get to your calls in just a moment. But first of all, Rachel, I've seen reporting on the psychological impact of living in an area targeted by drone strikes. Is that something your report looked into?
It is, and we sort of talked about, we talked with survivors, and specifically with the case that we talked about earlier with the 68-year-old grandmother who was, you know, killed by a drone strike in front of her grandchildren. You know, the neighbors and the children who were around that, that killing, you know, are terrified that they might be next. That's, you know, sort of the focus of our title of our survey is "Will I Be Next?" It's you know, sort of really looking into the idea of, you know, the type of fear and the type of terror that people live with when, you know, there are indiscriminate drone strikes happening in their neighborhoods and in their communities and villages.
And Letta, did you get a sense in this report of attitudes toward the United States after the strikes we're talking about?
Yes, very strong reactions. by those directly affected or whose communities were directly affected. Many Yemenis told us that these strikes make them fear the U.S. as much as they fear al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. Others said they had never had any animosity toward the United States before these strikes, but that now they do. And these attitudes play right into the hands of al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. And in addition to the fear and the anger, many Yemenis are just simply feeling helpless by the drone strikes, particularly because of this wall of silence where the U.S. does not explain to the relatives of civilians killed why they ended up in the strike. Were they considered collateral damage that was acceptable under the cold calculus of the but legal calculus of the laws of war, or were they innocents killed accidentally? The U.S. is not saying. And so, as one relative told me, we Yemenis are the ones who pay the price of the war on terror. We are caught between a drone on one side and al-Qaeda on the other.
Mm-hmm. We'll go to our callers now. We have Joe on the line in Lansing. Hi, Joe.
Hi. When these kind of problems come up, I always think, what if Saudi Arabia wanted to have an air base in Iowa so they could control ethanol? Or Syria wanted to cut a deal with Canada so they could send drones and spy or attack Kansas, let's say. And I always think, I think our government needs to realize that they are fueling the fire with this attitude. And it concerns me that they act on such a short-term time frame and not really look at the larger picture of how we are perceived as a country.
Thanks, Joe, for the call. Letta, that lines up with what you were just saying about Yemeni opinion.
Yes. And I think the U.S. is setting a very dangerous precedent here. Not only does this stain the U.S. image very much in the way that Guantanamo did during the Bush administration and continues to under President Obama, but this sets up, this gives the green light to other countries to go into countries, and it might even be the U.S. at some point, to take out whomever they please in the name of countering terror, whether that is the justification or not. And drones technology is growing. It's not as if the U.S. is the only country that possesses attack drones, and I imagine that in the coming years, many other countries will have this technology.
Joe, thanks
and
for the.
And in fact, in May of this year, President Obama promised to increase transparency around drone strikes, but they have yet to do it. So it's, I don't think it's that, you know, they don't think it needs to happen. You know, it's that I think there's some sort of lack of urgency or, you know, whatever issues. But, you know, the fact is that the world needs to know how many people were killed about drone strikes and who they were and why they were targeted.
Thanks to Joe for the call. We'll go to Don now in Grant County. Don, hi.
Hi there.
What did you want to bring up?
I realize that we aren't at war with Yemen or Syria or anybody at this point, besides al-Qaeda. But if you would look, you were talking about the rules of war being followed before. Well, if we were back in World War II and if we had the didn't have the technology that we do nowadays, there would be thousands of casualties that weren't meant to be casualties.
Gotcha. Thanks a lot, Don. Just a couple minutes. Rachel, there are civilian casualties, but things would be worse without the technology we have now.
Right. Amnesty's position is that not all drone strikes violate human rights or humanitarian law. We're not anti-drone. But the full picture will only come to light when U.S. authorities fully disclose the facts and circumstances and the legal basis for each of these drone strikes. So we're not, you know, we're not at all, you know, anti-drone. We think that it's a tool that could be used effectively. But what we question is the way that this tool is being used right now.
Just briefly, the White House response so far has been, hey, we only do these attacks when we're really close to sure that civilians won't be injured in the limited response I've seen today. Letta, what do you make of their response so far to your report?
Well, that's certainly not what we saw in the cases we examined. So either the policy of near certainty of no civilian harm was not followed at the time of the strikes we examined, or somebody willfully disregarded it, or something went terribly wrong.
And Rachel, in just 30 seconds or so, for national security reasons, maybe we don't want the details you want out there. We don't want people to know how we know there are terrorists out there.
I think that it's always tough to balance national security with, sort of transparency. But at the end of the day, we're not safer with these types of strikes happening. We are, it's counterproductive to human rights. It's a human rights violations, and it's not making us any safer as a country. So I think that that has to be included in the, in the calculation.
Rachel, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Letta, thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
Letta Taylor, Senior Terrorism and Counterterrorism Researcher at Human Rights Watch, and Rachel O'Leary, Deputy Director of Membership at Amnesty International.
Coming up, a world-renowned curator takes us behind the scenes in the art world. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, a look at what our guest is calling an epidemic of C-sections in American delivery rooms.
First, we go behind the scenes in the art world. Robert Storr is a curator, art critic, and painter. He's dean of the Yale School of Art.
He's coming to Wisconsin this week. He's speaking at the Madison Museum of Contemporary Art this Friday at 7:30.
Robert Storr, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Well, as a museum audience person who doesn't really know what's going on behind the scenes, I'm excited to talk to you about this. One thing I've noticed over the years in museums is kind of two different approaches to displaying art. Some places, it's almost a history lesson, lots of context, educational material, maybe even a recorded something. And then others, it's almost as though there's artist and title, and that's it, and it leaves it all to my interpretation. Is that a back and forth in the art world?
It's a back and forth, and it's a back and forth in the work of a given curator. I've done shows with no labels whatsoever, although I always give handouts that people can read at their discretion. And I've done shows that have been heavily posted with information. It depends upon the art. It depends upon the audience.
And what makes that decision? What kind of art? What kind of audience would you put more material out there for?
Well, for starters, with audience, if you can't assume that they know a good deal already, it's not really very democratic to just throw them into the deep end of the pool. On the other hand, you never want to talk down to the audience, no matter what you're dealing with. So, for example, if you were showing religious art of the 16th century, nowadays it might be necessary to explain the Bible stories that are in the pictures, whereas once upon a time people pretty much knew them. If you're looking at art that has an origin in some important chapter of modern art history and people don't know it, then you do them a service by telling them. But going to a museum is not going to a classroom, and an exhibition should not be a book on the wall.
And you've done a lot of work with the works of living artists. Is there ever a tension between putting up that information and the artist saying, no, that's not quite right?
Well, first of all, artists don't necessarily have the definitive answer either. Mm. So you listen to artists, but you don't. I've never done an exhibition where the artist told me what to do, nor ever accepted that an artist edit my catalog text.
Mm.
If they want to work with me, then they have to accept that I will interpret things in ways that they might think otherwise. On the other hand, I'm sensitive to what they think, and I do a lot of asking and interviewing before I go forward.
So that makes me think a museum, a curator is dealing with a lot of different constituencies. There are the art insiders, the art world. There's the donors. There's the public at large. How do you balance the different interests of those different groups?
Well, that's in a sense what the skill of the curator is. The curator isn't just an expert in the material. They are also diplomats. They're teachers. They're social engineers and so on. My basic feeling is that the first responsibility you have is to the art itself. The artist maybe comes second, or actually really the public comes second. The artist comes third, and the patrons and the administration and all the other constituencies come after those three. But the first thing is the work of art. You've got to do right by it.
I've seen you quoted as saying something along the lines of you're trying to create a forum where art and ideas can meet in an exhibit. How do you do that?
And where the public can meet itself, because, of course, members of the public differ, and they will see things differently. And you want them to understand that, number one, there is no right answer. Number two, the differences among them in interpretation, in emotional response, in pleasure, are important and part of the work of art itself. And therefore, you want to stimulate dialogue among them as well as between them and the work, them and the museum, them and the artist.
I think sometimes there's a perception from, I guess, the ordinary man or woman on the street that there's this art world out there that doesn't have much to do with our everyday life. Is that true? And is that necessarily a bad thing?
Well, there are parts of it that don't have much to do with their everyday life, even mine, which is pretty much committed to art. So, but I think the idea of a super elitist art world that looks down on the public is actually mistaken. And I think the idea that artists are trying to hoodwink the public is, in most cases, also mistaken. Making art is just too hard. And for most people, it's something that they don't get paid much for. There are huge prices for some things and very little reward for others. So the first thing you should sort of grant for the sake of better understanding is that maybe this crazy thing you're looking at was not done by a crazy person and was not done in order to get your goat. It was done because they had an insight that you have not yet had, and you're welcome to it if you wish.
I wonder about understanding the biography of the artist. Sometimes at talking to authors and you ask, oh, did this personal experience inform your writing? And very often the answer is no, not at all. Do we understand an artist better if we know their story as a person and as an artist?
In some instances, yes. In others, no. In some cases, for example, Louise Bourgeois, with whom I worked for 30 years, very closely, began talking about early childhood experience in her life a couple of years before she became truly famous. And those stories ended up being the sort of the prism through which people see her art. And that's been a problem for her because people haven't given her enough credit for the intelligence and the sort of synthetic imagination, and they sort of ascribe it to this acting out of trauma to a fault, right? And the same thing happened with Jackson Pollock. The reason Jackson Pollock made all those paintings was not because he drank hard or because he had a conflicted identity. It's because he was thinking about painting in a very specific way. So biography can be useful. It can also actually get in the way in a major fashion.
You've done exhibits in a lot of different places, and I want to talk about a couple of them. One, in Venice, you were, as I understand, the first American to curate the big Biennale, forgive
right.
my Italian,
right.
back in 2007, I think.
That's correct. Yeah.
What was it like being on that? I guess that is a big deal in the international art world. What was it like to do a show on that stage?
It's a very big deal. It was a very controversial Biennale. I am still feeling the repercussions of it in some ways. But it was also very exciting, and I worked with a colleague, Italian colleague, Francesca Pizzopaolo, who was a marvelous help in trying to navigate the Italian part of the equation. Doing anything in Italy is difficult. The fact that they had Berlusconi for their prime minister tells you how difficult. And anything in Venice is difficult by Italian standards times two. So,
how was it controversial? What rose up that's still sticking with you to this day?
Well, I tried to actually do what a lot of curators talk about. I tried to make a truly international multimedia exhibition where the curator was not the subject, but the art was the subject, and where the differences among the works of art were also the subject. And that really grated with a lot of colleagues who see themselves as kind of super producers of exhibitions, with the artists and the art being basically cast members.
And I had thought when I saw you did that, well, however hard it might have been, at least you're in Venice, but do you really get to appreciate a city when you're doing this big, high-profile project?
Well, I took my wife and our two daughters, and they had a great time. I had a good time, but I didn't have a great time because I was working too hard. But it's a wonderful city, and now when I go to it, I feel kind of a pride of citizenship almost.
And another premier art place, the Museum of Modern Art in New York. Talk about working in that venue.
Well, I worked there altogether on staff for 12 years, and then I worked for another 3 years after that to produce my last exhibition. And I had a wonderful time for most of that time. And I have many, many friends among the trustees, among staff members, and so on to this day. I did not get along with the director and ultimately realized that it was a no-win situation, so I left. But it's an amazing institution with all its flaws, and it will continue to be one.
And you've done art in American embassies. Can you talk about bringing artwork outside of the traditional galleries and museums?
Well, American embassies are a place where an awful lot of the world that doesn't actually come to our shores meets America. And the whole history of art in public buildings, particularly government buildings, is a very problematic one, and none of the artists I work with want to have their art be used as cultural propaganda or as being symbolic of a particular political message. I think many of them actually kind of dissent from a good deal of what the United States has done in recent years. But it's important that their work be known, and in the same way that people would read the novels of Kurt Vonnegut or you know, any number of writers who have been very challenging to America's image of itself, the art of America is like that. And it's good that it be in a place like that, and that people, when they come to do their business with the country, also see that we have a sense of humor about ourselves, also see that we disagree amongst ourselves, also see that we are of many colors and many cultures.
And speaking of culture, I think there's often an idea that in America, culture has to be culture, with a British accent, maybe a better one than I just delivered. Do we reach too much across the Atlantic for our ideas of high culture? Do we have enough of a uniquely American sense of our culture?
Well, I would say yes, but in the following specific way. I think we should talk no longer about the United States as being America, but the United States as being one of the Americas in the plural. And I think that from Tierra del Fuego to Baffin Bay, all of the countries with their different languages and their different ethnic mixes and so on and so forth belong to the post-colonial history of the great empires of Europe. And how each one of those countries has dealt with that legacy, how each one of these countries has produced its own modernist art is really, really interesting. So rather than seeing the United States as an isolated case, we should see the entire hemisphere as being a zone of cultural invention and of cultural conflict, and that all of it is interesting. And sometimes the best way to understand what was done in New York is to look at what was done in Sao Paulo or in Caracas or someplace else.
How do you play with that in an exhibit setting?
That's one of the things I did in Venice. That's one of the things I've done here. I mean, I recently invited Jack Lerner, who's a Brazilian artist, to come and live at Yale and make work with students, and she created an entire exhibition while at Yale. And her way of dealing with, now I will get into the cultural jargon, but the ready-made and the Duchampian kind of idea of art making is very different than what North Americans think of that. So to have a Brazilian tap into the same source but come up with something radically different was very useful.
Your talk in Madison is on Mr. and Ms. Inside Outside. In a nutshell, what kind of topics are you tackling there?
What I'm trying to address is the fact that often the world views, again, the culture a little bit, as you said, is the them and us situation. There's this cultural lead and there's everybody else. And then beyond that, there's this view as within that cultural lead, there are the power players in institutions and everybody else. But many of the most progressive, most imaginative, most risk-taking people in the art world actually work for museums, and they get very little credit for it, and they are often the best allies that artists have in terms of getting their work understood, seen, et cetera. So I want to talk a little bit about the fact that it's not a battle between the establishment and the avant-garde. It's a struggle that people in every possible position in the art world have in common if they really care about art more than money or prestige or all those other things.
We're talking to curator extraordinaire Robert Storr. In just a few minutes, I'll ask him to talk about some of the artists he's written about over the years.
You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. We pick up the conversation with art critic and curator Robert Storr of Yale University.
Robert, I wanted to talk to you about some of the artists you've written about over the years and talked about. Let's start. You mentioned earlier Jackson Pollock. That's a name I think a lot of us are familiar with. There's been a movie. His art is pretty well known. Why was he such a significant figure in 20th century American art?
Well, he was the one member of a large group of painters who sort of came to the fore in the late 30s, early 40s. The one member who made the most radically different paintings in terms of what modern art had looked up until that time. There's a famous quote of his where he said, you know, well, Picasso's the man to beat. But he's really the one who not only challenged Picasso directly, but made something that Picasso had never anticipated. And that was a kind of painting in which there was no central image, but where activity and vitality was spread out over the entire surface so that you would look at a small painting or a huge painting and get the same discharge of energy everywhere and in very intense doses. This was very radical, and other artists eventually came around to doing this, but Pollock was the sort of the one who really blew it out.
Was there a negative reaction at the time because this was so different?
Enormous negative reaction. He barely ever sold a painting in his life outside of a very small circle of supporters. He never really made very much money. By today's standards, he made nothing. So that he was notorious, but he was also, unrewarded. And he's one of the last members of the old avant-garde, the kind of Garrett artist who suffers and dies and, you know, becomes famous posthumously.
That isn't so much the story anymore?
No, I mean, actually, it was never entirely the story.
Okay.
Rubens and Velázquez were famous and rich in their own day. So the idea of the Garrett artist is really a 19th century phenomenon. But there was a time when it was more true than not for many of the important artists, and Pollock was one example.
Another artist, a name I'm familiar with, and I've got to say I'm not as familiar with his work, Gerhard Richter.
Okay, Gerhard Richter is, from my point of view, one of the most important painters of the post-1945 era. And the 1945 marker is important because Gerhard was born in Nazi Germany. Actually, he was born just as Nazi Germany was becoming Nazi Germany. He lived through the war. He then had his youth in East Germany under the communist Stalinist regime and came to West Germany and to Western culture in 1961, moments before the Berlin Wall went up. And he had a second life after that. And in his own life, and that's a case where the life story does matter, mm-hmm. In his own life, he's had to resolve all these conflicts. What's it like to have a Nazi for an uncle? Actually, what's it like to have a major war criminal for a father-in-law, which he did? What's it like to have grown up making Stalinist pictures and then abandon that and also the rewards that went with it and to begin again as an unknown artist making work that at the very beginning he didn't even like that much, but he knew he had to make? So he's a story of adaptation, survival, learning, and then he has made some just drop-dead paintings that have changed the way we think about the art form.
How so?
One of the things he's done is he's given himself the permission to mix and match, so to speak. So he will make all over abstract paintings which are not like Pollock's but take on some of the same issues. And then in the same afternoon, he will work on a painting which will look like Vermeer. And he sort of has dissolved this battle between figuration and abstraction, between the seemingly, sort of urgent emotional making of a picture and the patient fine crafting of a picture. He's dissolved those distinctions by showing that they're actually alternating currents in individuals and in the history of art.
So you're talking about how he was wrestling with the same issues probably all of Germany was, the post-Nazi era, the Berlin Wall era, eventually reunification. Do you think that he means something different to a German than to the rest of us looking in from the outside?
I think he does somewhat, and I'll tell you one other piece of the puzzle. In 1995, I went to Germany to see him for the first time, actually, and to negotiate the acquisition by MoMA of a group of paintings called the October Cycle. And it's October 18th, 1977, is the date of the paintings and the title of the paintings. And they're about a group called the Bader-Meinhof Group, which was a group of left-wing student political people who became actual terrorists.
Mm-hmm.
And I acquired these paintings because I thought they were amazing paintings. But they addressed the situation, which was in some way specifically German. And the story of this group and what it did is very much bound up in this post-war history and war guilt and so on. At the same time, we had the Weather Underground. We had the Black Panthers. We had the Symbionese Liberation Army. We had a whole lot of similar groups in this country. And no one in this country has ever tackled them in a serious way in pictorial art. And so I thought this would be interesting to have this work because it's such great painting, and there are reasons for that. But also, it would be interesting to see how Americans work through their own traumatic experience by considering that of someone in another culture.
It's amazing to think about how art, you think of something as so intensely personal and in a place and a time, and yet so often leaping beyond those bounds and becoming something of universal interest and appreciation.
Yeah. I mean, Robert Redford's just made a film on the Weather Underground or something very similar to it, right? So this is really part of our experience, and Richter has from his side. And mind you, Richter was an anti-communist who had fled East Germany, who had no kind of romantic feelings about revolution whatsoever. And what his interest was in how idealistic people could start out doing the right thing and end up doing the wrong thing. That was the subject of these paintings. Mm-hmm. And that's something that we in this country would do well to consider.
Another artist I wanted to talk about, Louise Bourgeois, you've written about.
Yeah, a great deal. I knew her for 30 years. I knew her before she got really famous. I knew her after she got really famous. And she lived until she was 90, almost 98. And she's an amazing artist because this is somebody who grew up when modern art was new. She went to school and studied with Leger, the French Cubist painter. She was friendly with the Surrealists because they have their gallery in the building where she had an apartment. She came to New York, and she knew Jackson Pollock. She knew Mark Rothko. She knew all these people. But she was a woman, and being a woman in that context was really tough. And she was determined to become an artist in her own way, and she did. But it took her years and years and years to, one, get the confidence to do what she needed to do, and two, it took her even more years till her 80s to get the attention that she deserved. So it's about the long slog that many women have had, and Joan Mitchell's another, and the list goes on, to get for women the kind of regard and consideration that male artists have had for many years.
When she found that confidence, as you mentioned, what did she bring to the art world? What was her influence then?
Profound. I mean, and one of the reasons that she was so important was that she was doing things that younger artists were doing, but doing them in even more radical ways, and often doing them before the younger artists started, so that when younger artists came up with these ideas, they looked to her as a role model. So in 1966, for example, the great curator and critic Lucie Lepard did an exhibition called Eccentric Abstraction, which was one of the first major appearances of Eva Hesse and Bruce Nauman. And Louise, who was 20 or 30 years older than them, was in that exhibition. In the 1990s and late 80s, when neo-expressionism and neo-symbolism came along, Louise was in those exhibitions because she was fresh. It was new work she was showing. So the idea that one has this kind of nice sort of parabolic rise and fall in a career is nuts. You know, artists who are really determined have very erratic attention. They have very erratic work. But the long-lived artists of that kind do amazing things all their lives.
I had more artists I was going to ask about, but we're a little short on time. And I wanted to ask you, is there an artist or two today who are not famous yet that you're keeping an eye on and would suggest we check out?
I'm always keeping an eye on artists, mm-hmm. and there are many of them. One who is pretty famous but not well-known in this country is Raymond Pettibone, who I think is an extraordinary artist. Another is Jack Lerner, who's from Brazil. I mean, there are many artists that I have put in my exhibitions and written about, and the reason I write about a lot of them is because I don't think it's ever been a matter of the one or two top people. Mm. It's always been a kind of delta of artists moving at different speeds and doing different things, but all interconnected.
Robert, thanks for joining us, and enjoy your visit to Wisconsin.
Thank you. I will.
That was Robert Storr, curator, art critic, and dean of the Yale University Art School. He's speaking at the Madison Museum of Contemporary Art this Friday at 7:30.
Coming up, why are so many babies delivered by C-section? Our next guest tried to find out why we have what she calls an epidemic of cesarean births.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.